or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AU Technologies. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by Congressman John Sarbanes, AFGE Communications Director Ina Doggett, and Philip Dre, author of There Is Power in a Union. Welcome back to Inside Government, Congressman Sarbanes.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So let's talk about President Obama recently signing your Telework Enhancement Act of 2010. Tell us about the bill.
Well, I was thrilled that we finally got it to the president's desk. We've been working on it for a while. It was a bipartisan bill. We had support from both Republicans and Democrats. And the basic idea was to bring teleworking into the federal workforce at a higher level. There have been some agencies, as you know, that have embraced it more than others, and they've found when they do so that productivity goes up, morale increases, there's all kinds of cost savings and efficiencies that you achieve, and we wanted to make sure that there was a law in the books that said telework's a good thing, we ought to try to embrace it, we ought to create policies within the agencies and people that are focused on how this can be made more widely available. And my view is it meets many, many different objectives, and we can talk about those, but probably first and foremost, it allows the federal government to go into the marketplace and recruit people because we're being as nimble as any other employer is when we offer telework.
Now, obviously, there's a cost savings to taxpayers, for instance, when the federal government might have in the past shut down for weather or some other emergency, and now people can work from home. But let's talk about how we kind of incentivize when there's a non-emergency situation to get sort of that middle level of management to start being a little more progressive about doing this for people on the front lines.
The way you do that, I think, is you just begin to develop a culture within each agency's workplace that telework is central to the mission of the agency. And that's why in the past, it's been sort of, I guess, random or uneven in terms of whether telework is really part of what goes on in an agency, because it depended heavily on whether the leadership in that agency decided to pursue it. What we're trying to do with the legislation that's now been signed, and I must say, with tremendous cooperation from John Berry, the head of OPM, in this, is to create a more uniform commitment to telework across the federal workplace. And you do that by saying, look, every agency, as this bill does, every agency has to have policies in place that describe the opportunity for telework. Every agency is going to have a telework managing officer, somebody whose responsibility it is to make sure those policies are widely known to the workers and to help guide them in figuring out what the best opportunity for telework is. And there's a lot of flexibility within that, but the idea is this won't be an afterthought anymore. It'll be integrated into the overall approach in each agency. And so it's that kind of uniform commitment to telework that the legislation was designed to promote, and I think it will do that.
Are there any carrots and sticks in there, incentives to maybe, foster this more, or, any kind of penalties if people aren't really performing with this?
Well, when you're talking about individuals, I think it's really just making it clear to them that a telework is a critical part of the agency's approach. Because in the past, there have been people who worry, if I raise the topic to my supervisor, in an environment where not a lot of people are doing telework, am I somehow going to be penalized for that? And so, people might have been more reticent about exploring it. Now they'll know that because there's policies being put forward, that there's materials, that there's training opportunities, that there's a person they can go to find out more about the telework, I think they'll be much more comfortable about pursuing that on their own. So in that sense, I guess that's a carrot, right, to create that environment. The stick part of it might be, people who've been reluctant to even think about teleworking as part of their job, Now that there's somebody within the agency and there's policies and other attention to it, they're going to be forced to at least give it consideration. And what you end up with is the kind of dialogue between the workforce and the sort of supervisory part of the staff on the benefits of telework and where that can be best taken advantage of. So it's really about creating a culture. And what's interesting is if you look at the agencies, for example, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has been very progressive in their telework policies before now even. If you look at agencies that have embraced it, not only do they show enhanced productivity and so forth among those who are teleworking, but in fact, because they get more focused on sort of results and performance and how to measure that, they've improved their productivity across their entire workforce, both among those who are teleworking and those who are not. And that's the kind of efficiency and productivity that you want to promote any way you can across the federal workforce. Telework is one way of doing that.
And, you know, this really is a win-win. It's a win for the employees, but it also makes government more productive, as you point out. Have there been some studies, like you kind of mentioned with Patent and Trademark or any other places, maybe GAO has done to show some of these cost savings to taxpayers?
Some of the agencies have been able to demonstrate, for example, that they don't need to lease as much space to house their workforce because they have telework arrangements in place where people can be working from home. I want to also mention that, you know, as you promote telework, you start looking at the opportunity to create telework centers. So, you know, it may not be your home that you're working from. It may be a satellite location that you can go to, but it's still not requiring you to go into the agency proper. And there's efficiencies that are achieved that way. So there are agencies that have been able to demonstrate the results. Of course, when we had those snowstorms last February that shut the government down for 3 days, there were people who were able to continue their operations. This continuity of operations piece is very critical in terms of what telework can offer. And the estimate was that the government saved $30 million a day that would have been lost otherwise in terms of, you know, lost productivity because people were able to continue to operate and perform their duties during the snowstorm because they could do it remotely. So there's plenty of evidence that there's significant savings. The other thing, of course, is the private sector has embraced this for a long time. You look at you know, some of the country's best corporations, they do this, and they do it because it helps their bottom line. If it's helping their bottom line, it's because it's increasing efficiency and productivity and it's saving them money. And we're showing that the federal government can do that just as well.
And in this day and age when, you know, the federal government has budget issues, obviously there's talk of this freeze that, of course, all the federal employees are very upset by. But if you're trying to recruit the best and the brightest of federal service, this seems to be almost a no-brainer.
I agree. And if you can go into a competitive marketplace for the workforce and you can say, here are the various benefits, flexibility that we can offer you as a federal employee, you're going to get people's attention. And John Berry, I think, understood this from the day he arrived in his role as head of OPM, and that's why he was very, very committed to it. We worked collaboratively with him. He saw the wisdom, I think, of having a statute on the books, having legislation that makes this commitment so that regardless of who happens to be, you know, heading up OPM or in charge of a particular agency going forward, they're going to understand that the law has created an expectation that they invest and commit to telework. So we are very pleased to get this finally on the books, and I think the president, from his comments when we were at the signing ceremony the other day, certainly understands the benefits that it's going to bring.
Now, if you're a federal employee at the worksite and you're hearing about this now and you go, wow, this is something I really want to do, when does this really kick in? Does it kick in right away?
As far as I understand, it will kick in. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, the Office of Personnel Management has already been working hand in glove with each agency to make sure that they're focusing on this. So I know that that's already underway, and I would be surprised if federal employees haven't gotten some word that this is a real opportunity for them already. But what will help to further kind of reinforce that is that there are specific reporting requirements and evaluation pieces that we also included in the legislation, and I believe that the first one of those is due within 6 months or a year. I know that each agency is required to begin implementing a telework policy, establishing a telework policy within a year of enactment, and the Office of Personnel Management is meant to issue regulations on telework within 180 days of enactment. So you're going to begin seeing activity very soon at the agency level that will reflect the commitment this legislation calls for. And certainly any federal worker who's listening to this and is excited about the prospect is in a position to now go to the powers that be within their agency and say, I understand that the commitment's been made. I'm interested in it. I'd like to understand what the policies and opportunities are going to be. And I think they'll find a receptive audience for that.
As we come down to our last minute, when you next go before the Greater Baltimore Committee in your area and talk to them about this legislation and how it might impact, say, transportation and the environment, are we talking about teleworking maybe one day a week, or could it be as much as 4 or 5 days a week?
There's a lot of flexibility. The expectation when we were working on the legislation is that you would kind of view telework as at least 20%. So that's one day a week. But what we've discovered in talking with the agencies that have been more proactive about this is the more they get comfortable with it, the more they pursue it, obviously. And so you increase the amount of time that may be committed through telework. I want to make the point that, in some instances, telework's not going to work, is not going to be appropriate. There's certain kinds of jobs that involve, sensitive information, other things, or where you have to be on a site to do the job, where telework's not going to be really an option. And we were sensitive to that as we were developing the legislation. The point is to try to create open-mindedness about this so that the workforce has as much flexibility to pursue it as they can. And I think you're going to see that happen.
And we thank you for your efforts on that. We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees, looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Ina Doggett, AFGE Communications Director. Welcome back to Inside Government.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we've had another fantastic year with Inside Government, featuring a number of great guests and covered the most important topics for federal employees and AFGE members. As a Communications Director for AFGE, tell us about some of these points.
Well, I'm really proud of the work that we've been able to accomplish with Inside Government in terms of helping to communicate issues that are important to our members and important to our listeners as well. We have, through Inside Government and through a lot of our products, been able to connect with our members and also utilize those products to connect with the public. Most recently, we have launched electronic version of the Capitol Hill report that used to be in the print version. We now have an electronic version of AFGE we can review, and we also have an electronic version of the Rep Wing. And so we, in addition to that, we've expanded our social media presence with not just Facebook pages for AFG in general, but also for Inside Government. And I do want to see to my colleague who's in the, producer of this fine program, Jason Fornicola, who is seated to my left, to talk a little more about Inside Government.
Yeah, so we've had a great year, another year, which I think we can say that we have made a lot of improvements. Even most recently, we've launched a new logo to reflect a little bit more who we are. As you know, we don't just do radio. We also have a strong video piece, which we have titled Inside Government TV. We're on iTunes. We've got a strong social media presence through Facebook and Twitter. We're trying to maintain a cutting-edge mentality to some of the things that we do. We also have continued our travels across the country to a number of events to participate in some radio rows. I think a couple that come to mind are the Families USA. We have also been to, this year, we've been to the VA Council's Triennial Convention, which was a very good experience. And we travel to the Excellence in Government conferences, and also America's Future Now by the Campaign for America's Future. So we really have tried to put ourselves out there and make ourselves known and be relevant in the conversations that are important to federal employees.
And do you find that in many ways, when you go to the conferences and we do that setup there, that it really is very interactive? I mean, there's a lot of folks, whether they be at AFGE events or even other events, people learn about the show, they give us feedback, they give us story ideas, we get guests that maybe we wouldn't get any other way. I mean, do you find that's one of the best things we do?
Absolutely. You know, it really is a way to reach out and connect with your listeners and, of course, our members. When we travel to places and events that are unique to our members, whether it's, you know, a conference or a convention, or even an organizing event, we found, as you well know, going to those things, that that's one of the best ways for our members to learn about us, to see what we do, and to see the efforts that we put into making their voice heard.
And Enid, let's talk again about the communications department. You've had another great year. AFG's had another great year. Got a lot of stories out there. Got a lot of press. People know who we are and what we're talking about. Tell us about some of those things and other things the department's been doing this past year.
Well, first I want to give a shout out. I mentioned Jason Fornicola, who, in addition to producing Inside Government, also works on our Bureau of Prison Issues. We have a new addition to the team, Tim Kaufman, who of late was with the Federal Times and now is with AFG Communications working on Department of Defense and Veterans Affairs issues. Christina Erling continues to do the fine work that she's been doing with Social Security and with a lot of our collateral. Speaking of collateral, we have a new publication that Christina produces and writes, The Real Deal for our Social Security employees. Emily Ryan has been manning the helm on TSA, and we had Michael Victorian and some other people who have supported us. And Michael recently left for law school, but he was with us for some time. And we work very, very closely with Michelle Groom and also Chelsea Bland, who is Secretary Extraordinaire and Coordinator of our Editors Association, which not only includes editors who deal with written publications, but also now digital editors. And we have also created some training platforms for social media for our folks.
And, of course, one of the big issues coming up right now has been the freezing of federal employee pay. What's been your reaction to that?
Well, we have had an interesting strategic reaction to the freeze on federal pay. You know, it's the position of AFGE that this, you know, was a PR move by the administration. And unfortunately, it has seeded the attacks or the ongoing attacks on federal workers. We are working collaboratively with the other departments within AFGE, as well with our members in particular sectors, to deal with this onslaught. And we are certain, under the leadership of John Gage, J. David Cox, and Augusta Thomas, as well as our bargaining councils and our board of directors, will be able to proceed and push back this attack. Federal employees are the anchor of the many services and things that this country receives, your water, your air, you know, even you get on a train or you get on a plane, when you get in a car, when you drive on a highway, for folks that are in communities where there are things such as, you know, federal prison facilities, those guys protect the community. In addition, they are part of those communities. So, you know, to see federal workers, you know, and this, and the work that they do being shunted, and, you know, and the misconception that they are somehow overpaid, lazy hacks, is, for those of us who work very closely with these groups, it's very insulting to see this.
And do you find you get a lot of feedback from the members, particularly around this issue? I know I was out at an organizing drive last week, and people were just coming out of the woodwork to join the union, to thank us for our efforts fighting for them, because at this time where people are talking about tax cuts for the, you know, super wealthy and the billionaires, the federal employees who are out there at the Bureau of Prisons, who are at veterans hospitals taking care of our American heroes. I mean, these are the folks that don't understand why a billionaire would need a tax cut, but they get a pay freeze. And do you think that that's ginning up, I guess, the organizing and membership drive for the union?
Well, I think in a lot of ways, it, you know, since they feel definitely targeted, you know, so unfairly, that has definitely created a level of enthusiasm about some of AFGE's activities. And we are, after all, the largest federal employees union. We now have, you know, like hundreds, literally hundreds of stories that we've received from our members and non-members about the work that they do day to day. And we are utilizing those on a new social media site. AFGE members tell their stories at unionblog.com. So for those who'd like to see the stories.
And with that, as people see AFG standing up and as the message gets out on all the issues that AFG stands up for our members on, is that having an impact with the transportation security officers in that campaign?
We've always sensed a great deal of passion with our TSOs, and they are some of our more ardent supporters and believers in the work that we do. And we feel that the work that we do for AFGE enhances the work that they do for the American public.
And they came under a lot of scrutiny over the Thanksgiving holidays and the new policies. And AFG stood with our members. I mean, I think our members saw that we were with them.
I think, you know, given the level of press attention that they get, that and the fact that they are under the gun, that they definitely feel validated by our presence in working with them, not just in the communications arena with Emily Ryan taking the helm, but also with the effort of our member and organization department, as well as our legislative department and field services department and Office of General Counsel. I think that they feel that they are getting the support that they need to do the jobs that they do, and that in turn makes them people who support and endear themselves to AFGE.
Now let's talk a little about your life. You've dedicated your life to media and public relations, a lot of it in the D.C. area. And I know you're often shy about talking about yourself and your background, but that's important. People want to know about that because you've been the communications director and you bring a lot to the table. Tell us a little about your background and what it's like being a communication professional in Washington.
Being a communications professional in Washington is a lot of fun. I actually got my start in communications at Federal News Radio sister station, WTOP AM, and I've worked for more than 30 years now in the broadcast and public relations fields. I have a lot of friends who are very dear to me, who work the other side of the aisle on many issues, but who still maintain a collegial relationship. Washington has always been one of those cities where, you know, you may be on one side on an issue, but at the end of the day, you come together to work together and, you know, you believe in, you know, that all politics aside.
And, you know, in your role at AFG, one of the things that often, I think, goes unnoticed, except by the people that really get to see what your department does up close, is a lot of the mentoring that you do and a lot of the internships for young people and the opportunities that you've given young people to come through the department. Talk a little about that.
Well, of now, and I have to say this was President Gage's idea, that we start an internship program at AFGE. And of late, you know, we have interns from Howard University, American University, Syracuse, all over. We do ask that they email us at communications@afge.org, anyone who's interested in an internship. But, you know, it's been a wonderful thing to see a lot of these young people go on and grow into other career paths. One of the young ladies that worked with us at AFGE is now an attaché in Brazil. Another young man is a public service director for minority affairs at Procter & Gamble. And one young lady is now a minister in New York. So we've definitely seen a lot of them take challenges, but they all do, you know, regularly touch base with us and come back to us and let us know about the experience that they had. And also we'd like to note, you know, to note, we do notice that a lot of these young people do help spread the word about federal workers and D.C. government workers. And one other thing I do want to give a quick shout out that I didn't touch on when I was talking about the things that we did, and that was the work that we did in Washington, D.C. with MVP Dwight Bowman and his, you know, the astounding, our D.C. leaders, our D.C. local presidents came through and they helped the city to elect a new mayor, and they got our issues out front, and they were the true labor leaders in this city in that particular election.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us, and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. I've been joined by Philip Dre, author of There Is Power in a Union, the epic story of labor in America. So welcome to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little about the book. Why did you write it?
To be honest, I wrote it because I was a little concerned that nobody seemed to really know much about the history of the labor movement these days. If anything, labor has a kind of pejorative reputation, and I felt that there was a great story there, a great history, and so really that's what it was. That's sort of what got me started.
Now, do you have a history with the labor movement?
Well, I've been in a couple of unions, let's put it that way. I mostly have a history of writing about social justice movements in America, civil rights and the environmental movement, and it seemed to me the labor movement was sort of the granddaddy of them all, in a sense. You know, it involved millions of people, it went on for decades, it sought all these broad sort of economic justice goals, and it just seemed a shame that it wasn't really remembered very well. So that was really my aim, was to sort of do a kind of almost nostalgic sort of post-mortem of the labor movement, which is sort of it's been in decline lately, but it really brought us to where we are in so many ways. It kind of shaped the America we all know, and I felt it was worth remembering.
And as you've done some of the, I guess, book signing events and talked to people about the book, have you found that some of the major accomplishments the unions have done over the years, and let's talk about some of those, that people just simply didn't even know?
Oh, absolutely. You know, especially people, younger people, I think they don't realize, you know, since, say, 1980 or so, you know, labor has been kind of in decline a bit. There have been a lot of rumors of corruption, labor, you know, unions being accused of being greedy about pensions, that kind of thing. And so its reputation is not really that strong. And so absolutely, you get a lot of questions about, you know, why would you write such a book even, what do you hope to prove, that kind of thing. And really, it's more I think just a matter of trying to refresh people's memory about what a strong movement labor really has been in America, really since the beginning of the 19th century.
And let's talk about some of those accomplishments. I mean, the eight-hour day, for instance, a lot of people seem, especially younger people, seem to think that that's just what it's always been, and that's not true, is it?
No, you know, it's been very interesting to me. In fact, more so than I thought when I started the book, you know, no one ever gave labor anything. It's really been an uphill battle all along for shorter hours, safe conditions on the job, minimum wage, what have you, you know, health benefits, vacation benefits, that kind of thing. And so really labor has had to kind of carve out these victories for themselves. And often, you know, it took the government a very long time to get involved. For many years, it was just employers versus employees, basically. And, of course, as you can imagine, you know, usually corporations had so much more power than individual workers. So with the courts and with sometimes federal troops aligned against workers, it was really an uphill battle and one that really labor only in very brief periods could be said to have enjoyed like a golden period. For a lot of the time, they were struggling.
And, you know, I think often people think, like today, if labor gets a gain, it's because people went up to Congress and provided testimony and votes were held. But that wasn't really how a lot of labor accomplishments were made. I mean, you mentioned things like the Haymarket Square incident and things like that. And talk a little about what that was.
Well, you had basically in the 19th century, you had, you know, a lot of the effort was for shorter hours because initially companies had people working 10, 12, 14-hour days, often for poor wages. There were very few protections. There was no grievance procedures, that sort of thing. And so with the government refusing to get involved, you know, for many years, mostly in the 19th century, the government took the position that it had no right to intervene between a company and workers. And so basically they were left to themselves to kind of deal with these issues. And that's why you had a lot of strikes. You mentioned Haymarket. Of course, before that, you had the great railroad strike of 1877 when workers basically shut down the nation's rail system. There was quite a bit of violence and destruction as federal troops confronted angry workers and the unemployed. You had Haymarket, where you had people striking basically for an eight-hour day. Then there was, in that instance, of course, there was a bomb thrown at Chicago policemen, killing several of them. It was never proved who did it, but several anarchists were executed for it. You had the Great Pullman Strike of 1894. Again, the rail system shut down, federal troops sent in, court injunctions used against unions, union leaders put in prison, including the great Eugene Debs. So that was a kind of violent and turbulent history of unions in the 19th century, which eventually government finally got active and sort of sought to intervene and tried to get what they called industrial democracy, in other words, a sort of calming of industrial relations so these huge strikes could be avoided. The strikes, let's face it, they were non-productive. They stopped industry, and eventually corporations awoke to the fact that labor unrest was no good for anybody. It didn't help their bottom line either. So that's when you began to see a breakthrough in the early 20th century of corporations starting to recognize that they had to do something to meet workers halfway.
And do you feel, though, maybe beginning with the Patco strike and from then on, that it's almost been an era of take-backs and give-backs? I mean, companies constantly are coming to unions. Federal employees are having it now with this pay freeze, where they come and say, okay, you've got to give something back. The auto workers making concessions in Detroit. Has there been is it more of a recent struggle in just keeping what folks have earned?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's been true since the early 80s. That, you know, it has to do not only with the aggressive sort of anti-union actions of someone like President Reagan and the PATCO strike against the air traffic controllers, but of course there are a lot of underlying issues, the major one being globalization, because American jobs can be outsourced to other countries that are where the workers are non-unionized, low-wage jobs. Yes, obviously American workers are on the defensive, and so what a lot of it has been about recently, in recent years, has been about give-backs. In other words, what will unions give up or give back in order to keep corporations afloat and keep jobs in America? So it's been a very weak time for unions in a certain sense. You mentioned the UAW, where, you know, a lot of pension guarantees, things that had been agreed upon in earlier contract negotiations, are now the companies seek to get some sort of you know, weakening of those agreements, something that will allow them to avoid these huge pension and health payouts in workers' later years. So no, you're absolutely right. It's been a lot of retreating on the part of big unions, trying to do what they can to protect workers' rights. But yeah, basically, they're not holding a very good hand.
And really, during all of this time about what unions have to give back, nobody's ever talking about what corporations have to give back. I mean, is there any push there to have corporations give anything back?
Well, I think to a certain extent, of course, there always is. You know, unions do what they can. You know, I think, you know, you see this with the teachers union a lot now. It's been getting a lot of publicity. You know, because basically what happens is at an earlier stage, companies will promise, in lieu of higher wages, they'll promise something at the end of the rainbow. In other words, like, oh, well, your retirement benefits are going to be very full and health benefits will take you to the grave and so on. They do that as a way to avoid having to pay higher wages in the near term. Well, then, of course, when the bill comes due, the company says, whoa, we owe billions of dollars each year in benefits to our retirees. We can't afford this. It's breaking the bank for us. Can't the union do something? So, of course, then the union members feel a little bit double-crossed because, well, they've been going along for years thinking, well, I have this rich retirement awaiting me for my deferred wages all these years. And so there's a little bit of resentment, of course, from union members then feeling like, well, why did we agree to this 20, 35 years ago? And that's where you see a lot of the tension. But, of course, unions recognize that often they do have to give back something or accept less, different types of pension structuring, that sort of thing. So it's a give and take, and of course it's a source of a lot of enmity, and unfortunately a lot of that kind of rebounds negatively, I think, for unions. The public reads the newspaper, they think union people are greedy, why are they demanding all these retirement benefits and so on, but those are things that were agreed upon, and of course nobody likes to give up something they've already got. So when you've got a pension or retirement or health benefits that have been promised you, you're reluctant to forfeit them.
And let's, I guess, change points a little bit here and talk a little about the crisis of 1919. In your book, you talk about several key points in labor history. What was the key point in 1919?
Well, one of the problems there, of course, was you had the, it was a number of things. You had, of course, a lot of returning war veterans. You know, during the First World War, there'd been a lot of buildup of industry. A lot of immigrants had been hired for jobs. A lot of returning veterans could not find work. There was high unemployment. At the same time, you have a Bolshevik revolution had taken place in the Soviet Union, and there was a kind of a paranoia afoot in America about Bolshevism and radicals. And with the influx of immigrants into this country, which was tremendous in the early years of the 20th century, you had a lot of fear that the immigrant workers were being motivated by radical notions from foreign soil. And so that's, you have this kind of vicious sort of anti-labor reaction. Of course, it culminated in the famous Palmer raids of 1919-1920, where the Attorney General, Palmer, and his cohort, J. Edgar Hoover, who was then a young man, basically targeted a lot of what they thought to be radical labor unions and other radical groups, groups that had maybe been seemingly disloyal during the First World War, questioning foreign policy. And so there was a huge crackdown, and a lot of, you know, it was a very alienating influence on labor organizing generally, because people realized that they could get in a lot of hot water, get arrested, even deported for membership in a labor union. So it was a very kind of turbulent era, kind of a turning point, in a sense of sort of permanently tainting labor with this kind of radical image. I mean, that had gone on earlier, as early as the mid-19th century, even at the time of the Paris Commune of 1871. There was talk that that had infiltrated American labor. And that's something that we still live with today, the idea that, you know, labor, people involved in labor movements are socialists or they're, you know, they're collectivists or what have you. It's an old idea in America. It kind of strikes at the heart of something that's always plagued labor in America, which is the idea in America that the individual is kind of supreme. In the other words, that people just are not comfortable with the idea of these collective groups of workers looking for economic justice. And so that, in a way, is the essence of it. You don't see it so much in other countries, but you do see it a lot here.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We're continuing with Philip Dre, author of There Is Power in a Union, The Epic Story of Labor in America. As we talk about your book a little bit, in some ways we have some parallel situations going on with President Obama and how he's been viewed by labor and maybe a lot of progressives, and the New Deal. How was labor involved in the New Deal, and how was Franklin Roosevelt viewed by unions?
Well, the short answer to that, of course, is that labor unions came to really love Franklin Roosevelt. You know, let's back up a little bit. The truth is that the guarantees of the New Deal, the safety net guarantees of unemployment insurance, minimum wage laws, a guarantee of collective bargaining, even Social Security, these were things that had been asked for by labor movement people as far back as like the 1890s. And you often, if you read the history, you'll often see a lot of people will say, oh, well, this was the actual origin of the New Deal, pointing back to something in the early 20th century or even the 1890s. So those were things that labor had sought. And so, of course, when the New Deal actually arrived, Roosevelt, a lot of his aides, like him, had come out of New York State, which had a very strong kind of what you might call a worker interest, I guess, maybe because of the Great Triangle Fire of 1911, which had caused the New York State Factory Inspection Committee to come into being. There was a stronger kind of consciousness about the merit of having sensible industrial relations with unions. And so many of those same people, those same reformers, wound up in Roosevelt's administration. A good one to name is Frances Perkins, who was the first woman to be a cabinet member in America. She was the Secretary of Labor in the Roosevelt years. And these people were committed to the idea that unions belonged in America, and that that was good for everybody. It was good for industry, good for business. And so, in a way, that was a kind of a golden period for labor, and you saw tremendous advances in terms of corporations recognizing large unions like the UAW, the United Mine Workers, and quite a bit of progress made. And so, you know, Roosevelt, by 1944 or so, toward the end of his life, he was extremely popular among laboring people, and of course, that solidified the sort of marriage between labor and the Democratic Party, which continues to this day.
And you know, where do we stand with that today? As I was kind of mentioning, I know unions have wanted the Employee Free Choice Act for a long time. AFG is one of the transportation security officers to have collective bargaining. How has that marriage with the Democratic Party worked out?
Well, it's funny because there's a Mike Davis, who's a California historian, called it the barren marriage between labor and the Democratic Party. It has worked out and it hasn't worked out. You know, it goes back to Woodrow Wilson, actually, who was the first Democratic president to actually really come down on in favor of labor unions, although he didn't always deliver. And in a way, that kind of set the model. There's been frustration. Partly, I think unions often feel that they resent having no other option. In other words, they don't have their own. There is no labor party in America, per se. They're kind of bound to the Democratic Party. And, of course, they still are very loyal to it. On the other hand, of course, when the Democrats fail to deliver, you often hear grumbling that, well, why are we, you know, we're sort of joined at the hip with this political party that is not always willing to come through for us. With EFCA, which you just mentioned, the Employee Free Choice Act, of course, there have been efforts from Democrats, leading Democrats like Teddy Kennedy and President Obama, to get EFCA passed. As you know, it hasn't happened mostly because conservative Democrats in Congress have been willing to side with the Republicans in holding it up. And so, as what I understand now is that there are efforts being made to kind of rewrite EFCA to make it more palatable to conservatives. And the other effort that I think I've heard is going on is that people expect maybe some progress can be made just in regulatory agencies. In other words, taking it out of the legislative process completely and just going to, like, the National Labor Relations Board and seeing if there can't be some improvement or tweaking with existing rules, basically to make it easier for workers to organize. That's what this is all about. So it's a little push and pull, you know, two steps forward, one step back. I mean, generally people would say the Obama administration has been friendly to labor. It has made a number of little steps. I know in terms of federal workers, I believe Obama issued some executive orders easing organization among federal employees. But obviously, there's only so much he can do. I don't know if we'll see EFCA passed anytime soon. So there still is a fairly high degree of frustration.
And you mentioned some of the things that maybe brought this about under the New Deal. And you talk about the New York state issues, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about the fire and that situation.
Well, of course, that's very much on people's minds these days because the 100th anniversary is coming up in March. Triangle Shirtwaist was a huge garment worker strike in New York from 1909-1910, which was really one of the first massive sort of urban strikes in America. It was largely led by immigrant women, many of them who were very young. It involved tens of thousands of garment workers. Garment work generally, even to this day, remains an area in which workers are easily exploited. It doesn't take much capital to set up a garment factory. It's even going on abroad right now. You hear about garment factories in Indonesia and so on. The New York garment workers, though, had great militancy. They staged two successive strikes, which were largely successful at winning improved conditions and wages and that kind of thing. Unfortunately, they were not able to secure safer factory conditions. And so what happened in Triangle Shirtwaist is you had a deadly fire breakout in a garment factory in Lower Manhattan. About 150 young women mostly were killed. There were horrific scenes of workers throwing themselves from the top floor of a 10-story building onto the street below. And these images are seared into the American, collective memory in a sense. And it was a huge outcry followed for these mistreated workers who, despite their union gains, this particular factory had not been unionized. And thus, these workers were vulnerable. And afterwards, you saw a huge effort, starting in New York State, but eventually spreading all over the country, to improve fire regulations and other safety regulations in factories. And even to this day, a lot of the fire regulation safeties that we all enjoy, whether it's illuminated exit doors, fire drills, multiple exits, that type of thing, really kind of stem from the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. So, Francis Perkins once said that was the beginning of the New Deal, Triangle Shirtwaist, because it finally awoke a lot of reformers and even government to the fact that, we can no longer allow employers alone to be their sort of enlightened self-interest to govern relations with workers. There have to be government regulations. As you know, that was, not to get too distracted by this or too much off at a tangent, but, you know, the Supreme Court in the early 20th century had ruled that the government had no business making regulations governing the workplace, which, you know, today, to us, to our ears, that sounds incredibly naive. And so, in a way, Triangle Sureways really helped crystallize the great wrong in that and sort of urged government and pushed government to get more involved.
And have you found that that history really has been lost? I mean, I think that's one of the powerful things in your book is that, you know, in this era where people talk about getting government off our backs and too much regulation, you know, as if regulation just sort of happened for no apparent reason. I mean, there, you know, these kinds of events actually did happen when government wasn't regulating. And we see it today even with the BP situation in the Gulf, that actually if you had stronger regulation, there are major benefits to that. It keeps these kind of tragedies from happening.
Well, yeah, I think that's, you know, I think, as you know, that's a kind of a divisive issue. It has to do with the whole kind of free market. You know, let's face it, we live in an era when the free market reigns supreme, and everybody, a lot of people have this idea that, you know, the enlightened self-interest of large corporations is all we really need and let the market take care of itself and so on. And, of course, history has shown us that that's very myopic. Obviously, corporations, they're by their own definition of what a corporation is, their purpose is to make profits for their stockholders. And anything else is just sort of gravy. In other words, if they want to do good or some kind of altruism or what have you, and many do, of course. But at the bottom, you know, bottom line is, for in terms of regulations, to oversee these things and to set standards, you really need the government. And you see that, yes, you're right, it's not just in labor relations, but in all kinds of things. So, I mean, in a way, that's just like a different people you ask. Some people will, of course, immediately say, yes, government regulations, that makes perfect sense over food safety, labor safety, what have you. And then there are a lot of others, as you know, who resent it. They don't like, they see it as an intrusion.
And part of that resentment, do you think that played some role in corporations and those that were anti-union in pushing through the Taft-Hartley Act?
Oh, absolutely. I think Taft-Hartley was meant to be only the first step in basically rolling back the New Deal. In other words, the conservatives in Congress, by the late 40s, they thought, okay, you know, we've had enough of this liberal holiday that Roosevelt brought on us. They were after it all. And the only thing Social Security, I think the Republicans, you know, conservatives agreed was a sort of a good idea. But everything else, they were looking to gut it. And they thought Taft-Hartley would just be a first step. Luckily, that proved to be pretty much all they got at that time. But, you know, we see that even today. I mean, conservatives, as we know, still talk about changing Social Security and privatizing it, what have you. So they haven't let go of that dream. But yes, the Taft-Hartley Act was a way to kind of claim back some of the rights that labor had won the New Deal. And, of course, it was largely successful. You know, we live in the sort of the post-Taft-Hartley age when right-to-work laws, laws meant to sort of intimidate labor organization. You know, even at that time, they made labor leaders sign an affidavit that they weren't communists, which was at the time considered a very intimidating thing. So, yeah, it had a chilling effect, let's put it that way.
And do you think as we come into our last minute and we look forward, do you think that maybe overturning that, in addition to EFCA, are the kind of things that are necessary for the labor movement to grow back to what it once was?
Well, I think the good news is I think labor has woken up. I think for many years labor was in a kind of, you know, sleep at the wheel a little bit. It had become like a big business itself. Now it's more interested. It's back to organizing. As you know, there's been a lot of organizing of people who never were organized before, like, you know, hotel workers, car wash workers, grocery store workers. And there's also new interest in global organizing, which is really, in a way, that's sort of the cutting edge. In other words, capital has globalized, and labor's been paying the price for that. Now you see labor unions working in tandem with human rights groups, with anti-sweatshop groups, basically to try to bring pressure on companies on an international scale. And that's, of course, a very, very tall order. There have been some successes, but there's a long way to go. I think we're going to have to wait another 10 and 20 years to see how that works out. But I think that's kind of the future of labor, working on a global scale. And I think that would really be, in a sense, a smart thing for American workers and, of course, for workers abroad as well.
And say thank you to our guests this week, Congressman John Sarbanes, AFGE Communications Director Ina Doggett, and Philip Dre, author of There Is Power in a Union. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AV Technologies.